Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing Australian speculative fiction novelist Dr. Ben Peake. Welcome back to the podcast, Ben.
Thank you very much, Matt.
First up, congratulations on your deal with Tor UK for your fantasy trilogy, which was announced early last year, and for the subsequent sales in Germany and the US. I wanted to ask you, how has this deal changed your writing life?
You know, I don't know that it's changed my actual routine of writing too much. It's given me a bit more financial security, which is nice. That can't be overlooked. I mean, it's more money than I've ever gotten for anything in the last, 15, 16 years. And that's given me a lot of security that it is. Otherwise, you know, the days are pretty much the same for writing, you know. I teach kind of Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. I write kind of Tuesday through to Saturday. So, you know, it's generally how it works. It's about the same. I get more emails from publishers now. People send me book covers to look at. I get asked to blog books. It's very interesting.
So, you're finally famous.
I don't know about that, man. people do say it. I went to go pick up comics yesterday, and the guy in the comic shop is like greeting me as a novelist and stuff now, and I'm just like, cool. And I said, nah. And we had a conversation about running our own businesses, so that's kind of where it ends up now.
An epic fantasy trilogy is quite a departure from the work that you're known for, and I was wondering, what led you to write the breakout series that begins with The Godless?
It all seemed like a departure from the stuff I've published, but in truth, it's not really from, like, my own internal body of work. I mean, I started out writing big fantasy books when I was, like, 16 and 14 and stuff like that. I mean, the first book I ever wrote was, like, a huge first volume of, like, a multi-volume fantasy series that has thankfully been lost in some kind of computer kind of alteration, change, lost like that. I think my mum threw it out when I was a kid, and I was just like, ah, that had my book on it. She's like, you can write another one. And, you know, after I sort of finished high school, I had this sort of idea that I would write a big fantasy novel, get a ton of cash, and that would, like, spare me from having to learn some sort of sensible route of employment. But it didn't really pan out that way. And I fell in with, like, the local scene and writers and all that kind of stuff. And once you sort of learn about the road to getting published, a lot of people sort of said that you got to sort of start with short stories and progress down that line and things like that. And the truth was, that kind of interested me, and that's why I wrote a lot of early kind of fantasy short stories that were basically fantasy novels reduced to 5,000-word short stories. They were fantastically awful. And, you know, I mean, as you do, you just kind of learn more. And the truth is, I kind of stopped reading fantasy novels for a while, mostly, you know, just because I found a lot of other stuff. Like, I went to uni, my reading improved, I had learnt new things and stuff like that, and I just sort of drifted into the work that I'm kind of well-known for now. You know, the more sort of, like, experimental kind of odd stuff is just kind of where my interests went. But in general, like, that original kind of desire to write giant, big fantasy books never really kind of left me. So when a few years back I was considering sort of giving this gig up after I'd had my most amazing run of two agents and multiple publishers falling through for, like, the Red Sun novel, I actually took a big step back. Like, I left a lot of the internet stuff and I left a lot of the scene stuff. I mean, I wasn't really hugely around in that to begin with, and I just took a step back and sort of tried to remember all the things that got me sort of interested in this kind of deal, you know. I mean, I didn't really, when I was a kid, I wasn't reading kind of experimental and odd stuff. I was reading big fantasy, and I just took a step back and I just thought I should write, you know, just something that'll, I don't know, be for me, you know, and that'll play to the stuff that I did as a kid. And so that's what I wrote, and then someone gave me a big chunk of cash and said, yeah, if only you'd done this, like, you know, 7-8 years ago, you'd be all right. I'd be like, thanks. Thanks. That original plan coming through. So you know, I think of it as like a 17-year deviation from my original career plan. I just kind of got back to it after a while. It's, you know, working out for me now.
Oh, nice. That's really good. I was overjoyed for you, actually, when we heard the news last April. I thought, because I read some of that backstory to, you know, you'd been, I wouldn't, well, maybe struggling's the right word, you know.
No, I had been. I would easily cop to that. Like, the Red Sun novel was a big setback, you know. I thought that was going to come through. I thought it was going to be a sort of break. I'd sort of listened to a lot of people where I shouldn't have as well. A lot of people had told me that I was going to, you know, break out in a big way and go to a lot of places. And when that all really didn't happen, you know, you learn a lot about who you are and sort of like what you're doing. So I'll cop to struggling and being in a bad place for a lot of that. I mean, that's fair enough.
Okay. Well, moving on to something that I've read recently, in Dead Americans and Other Stories from, is it Cheezine or Chizine?
I think it's Cheezine. I've never heard anyone pronounce it because, I mean, they might call it Chizine, but I think it's Cheezine. Anyone I've heard pronounce it says Cheezine, so.
But we'll stick with that.
But if Brett or Sandra are listening and they say it's the other way, then clearly it's the other way.
Well, in that, there was a tribute to Octavia Butler in the story, Octavia Butler, a remix. And I just wondered if you could tell listeners why Butler had such an impact or had such an influence on you as a writer.
Well, Butler was, you know, sadly died much before her time. But she was basically one of the first real kind of like authors to push that kind of racial equality through her fiction. Especially, you can see it really from the first book, which is, I've forgotten what her first book's called. It'll come back to me. But you can see it through even through the first book, which is this novel about going back through time to like slavery, like this black woman gets sort of like transported back to time and sort of like experiences this whole kind of like slavery industry and stuff like that, which is entirely horrific. But what really struck me as one of the most interesting parts of what she was doing is that Butler was very interested in her portrayal of race, was very kind of like universal. She seemed to have an understanding that, you know, equality went across all the boards. So in her relationship that she has in that book, the character who gets sent back in time is in a relationship with like a white kind of like male character, and that forms a part of the dynamic of her kind of trips back to and from through time. And that kind of like interracial relationships and questioning of what identity is through race and things like that continues a lot through Butler's work. It's most prominent, I guess, in the Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talent kind of novels, which to my mind are the best of her novels. And just in her general work, you know, I think it's the Exogenous kind of series is like much more about gender identity and stuff like that. So there are all these like really kind of interesting kind of racial overt themes and stuff like that that I really kind of like connected to as a person, and I was forever very grateful of that out of her, both her books, all her books.
Okay, and I'm conscious that you've grown up in Western Sydney, or you've lived in Western Sydney for a considerable amount of time, and for listeners outside of Australia, can you describe the cultural milieu of Western Sydney for our listeners and how that might tie in with your focus, as we'll go on to talk about, with race?
Western Sydney would probably be what you would call the cauldron of multiculturalism in Australia. In mainstream press, it'll get a rap for being basically the redneck part of suburban Sydney, where every kind of racist policy comes out is basically originated in the depths of this place. But it's actually an incorrect portrayal, since basically most, I would say, 60 to 70% of refugees and people who come from other countries and other cultures end up actually living in the depths of Western Sydney. So it's actually a very multicultural and kind of like broken apart, kind of racial diverse kind of area with many different kind of like ethnic communities sort of like colliding and interacting around each other. It's been like that for as long as I can remember since I was born here.
Okay, and so I read an interview that you did, looks like it's going back nearly 7 years now, with Brendan Connell. And I was just wondering if you could talk a bit about your first perceptions or your first realizations about race, and that when you were conscious that, you know, aside from the you know, the friends that you just played around with in the yard, when did it sort of become obvious to you that there were, I suppose, would be Frisians a correct word in the community?
The kids you play with and you grow up with, you don't really see those Frisians too much. You know, I mean, nobody, there. When you're a little kid, Frisians in race and stuff is mostly from your adults. Things like that I heard from my mother would occasionally say things that I disagreed with entirely. And I guess, but for me, I guess really the biggest kind of start of it is, there was the centenary thing for Australia. You remember that, like, you know, 200 mm-hmm. years and all that kind of stuff. You're probably old enough to remember it as well as I am.
Yeah, I am, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was like in year five when that came around, maybe year six or something like that. And so I was in primary school at the end, and where I live, Toongabie is actually the third settlement of Australia. And it's got nothing else to recommend it historically beyond the fact that it is the third settlement. And so the area had this whole thing where they wanted to do, you know, this big centenary thing and all that kind of jazz. So naturally, because we were in the public school, we got roped into it. And what I remember is they gave us all these T-shirts to wear, right? And the T-shirts had, like, shackles on them, you know, like convict shackles and shit like that. And you know, the school was in, like, a kind of diverse area, and there was, like, Indigenous kids and stuff, and they were all there wearing, like, these white shirts with, like, brown shackles on them. And it's like the school and the adults had never even heard of the word irony and had never, didn't even stop to consider the awful implications of, like, Indigenous kids wearing these shirts. And it's horrific, really, and terrible, but they just didn't stop and think about it. And that's kind of, I remember that very, very clearly. And, you know, I mean, there were lots of other things going around that time that I actually didn't realize. Like, I saw an interview with someone, they did a documentary. If I can remember the title of it, I would. As you can see, I'm terrible with titles. But anyway, it was about that time and about, you know, Hawke, like the Prime Minister of the time, Bob Hawke, got up and he gave that speech about the founding of Australia and everything. And it was kind of like at the edge of the Terra Nullis kind of time. And through Redfern, like through Australia, there was this huge march up to Redfern from Indigenous people and white people to, like, mark the day and mark the fact that they were being completely ignored in history. And I had no idea that that was going on at the time. I was too young to notice that kind of thing, really. But, I mean, it just sort of plays into that whole thing with the kids and the T-shirts and, you know, the sheer wrongness of it, you know, and that deep sense of wrongness that still kind of, like, goes through our society about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so I don't know that under this present government that we've gone too far forward from that. But
No. I mean, I'll give Avedis credit. He's very big on sort of promoting Indigenous things. Not that he does really anything for it, but all the other stuff is awful, embarrassing, and completely terrible. And yeah, I mean, it's we should be ashamed by the way we treat asylum seekers. It's
all right. Then I think we might come back to that in another question. But I was noting on the cover of The Godless, which was previously called something else, which has left me. But
it was called Immolation.
That's right, Immolation. Thank you. At least you can remember your own titles.
That's right. I can remember my own titles. At least this week.
Yeah, this week. I noticed, and I'm pretty sure that Tor UK did put out feelers about the cover, and I'm quite happy that the cover of Godless hasn't been whitewashed. We've got quite clearly an Asian-looking person on the front cover, and we can see her face. So I wondered, sort of focusing on this race and racism, how does is that explored in The Godless, or is it... I'll let you speak to it anyway.
Yeah, I guess... I don't know. The first thing to acknowledge for the cover, because I think a lot of people are going to give me credit for the cover, and I really shouldn't actually get credit for it. You know, the person who came up with doing the cover was actually Julie Crisp, the editor and editor and stuff like that, and she wanted to put the IA character, she wanted to put her on, like, the front cover and make a statement with that, so it was entirely her idea. I mean, left up to my own devices, I wouldn't even have people on covers, man. My personal pet hate is people on covers. Like, I stand behind the thing that's going on with this cover, like putting a non-white, non-male character on the front of the cover to sell it. I think that's actually a very important thing and totally supportive to do it, and I stand behind it 100%. But left to my own devices, I would have some abstract, weird thing that didn't even look like a thing on the front, because that's my personal preference for covers. So that cover stuff came from Julie, and she's like right there for it. You know, I mean, she's there pushing it. So for all credit for the cover, should really go towards the Tour UK people, and in particular Julie Crisp for that, because it's her. She stood up for it, and she said, this is what I want to do. And I said, sure, fine. Are you sure we can't have some sort of abstract cool thing? And she said, no. And I said, all right, okay. You know, so that's what. As for race in the book, I don't know that you'll find a huge set of racial politics running through the book. I've kind of shifted around a little for something different in the fantasy book, which was that I wanted to present a world of equality. And so, like, I mean, there's this big debate in fantasy fiction, right, that it's inherently conservative, okay? And that debate is a fair enough one, really. I mean, when you put basically monarchist kind of, like, governments and a lot of narratives are about, like, restoring sort of, like, God-selected people to thrones and things like that, and... that stuff's fairly kind of like regressive politically speaking, you know what I mean? A lot of the characters are white, and you know, a lot of the roles for women are carry that ridiculous, like, historically accurate term, because there's nothing as historically accurate as, like, you know, a dragon and a woman who works in, you know, it's not allowed to go outside, you know. Look at the dragons from your window. Isn't it fantastic? So when I was sort of, like, designing my world, I deliberately wanted to step away from that, because I just, you know, I wanted to just do something interesting for myself, but mostly because I don't gel with that as an adult. Like, it just doesn't drive me. Like, I like fantasy books, and there are a number of fantasy books that don't kind of do that. Like, the Stephen Erickson Malazan series doesn't really have that kind of narrative, but the George Martin stuff kind of does, you know?
Yeah.
And so I wanted to step away from it, so I decided in the building blocks of the world would be this idea of equality. And so, you know, I tried to present a world where everybody's equal, and there's not this idea of sort of like racial token individuals and gender token individuals and stuff like that. I just wanted a world where everything was equal, and that would be like this fundamental building block to the world, rather than being a thematic element that the characters would wrestle with. Because I kind of felt like I'd done the thematic elements of that already in, say, you know, Black Sheep, and I interacted with it a lot on, you know, the Octavia Butler story and things like that. And so I wanted to take a different vibe to it. And in the kind of Dead Americans collection, you'll see the kind of early parts of that thought, like when I'm dealing with, to a degree, kind of race and kind of like sexuality and gender. Like, the Under the Red Sun stories are pretty good. Like, you got two characters in it that are basically, you know, gay men, but I wanted to create a story where their gayness was, like, just a thing. It was just their relationship. The story wasn't about the fact that they were gay or anything like that. And so I wanted to have a story where everything was equal, where race was there, where it's kind of acknowledged within the text, but the equality of it was a building block for the world, if that makes sense.
I think so. And I think you achieved that with those three, is it three or four Red Sun stories?
Yeah, there's four Red Sun stories in the collection, yeah.
Okay. All right, then. Still sort of, I feel like I'm hammering in on this race point.
That's okay. I can talk about it all day, man. That's all good by me.
But this next question sort of might allow you to expound on other things. As you said, Black Sheep does explore race, and particularly race in Australia. It's a dystopia of a future segregated Australia. And I presume it was written, I had to actually go back and check my political list last night, I presume it was written towards the middle of the Howard era, so that was a decade or more ago. And I'm just thinking, if you had written it, say, under this perhaps more conservative, even more conservative current government, what book might you have delivered under current influences?
I think I wrote, maybe that was, I think it would have been the start of the Howard era, actually. It came a lot out of the Pauline Hanson kind of stuff. I think with the original concept and the reaction to that, there was a lot of interesting like academic work written in response to Hanson, who was not overtly a very interesting kind of politician or person. If I wrote the book now, it'd be very different. I mean, as a book, Black Sheep is a very flawed book. You know, I mean, it's my first book and feels like my first book, you know what I mean? I mean, of interest to people, really, for the book now, let's be honest, you know, I don't think it's a very good book, but, you know, I won't disown it because I think the evolution that I am as an author sort of begins in that book, and if you're interested in seeing that evolution, and that's going to appeal to only like a small select of people, but if you're interested in that, there's the book that starts it. And like, I want to acknowledge that element because I personally, as a reader, I find those things very interesting on authors that I really like. I like seeing the evolution of authors sort of play out and things like that. And that's just, yeah, I just like seeing that. So the book itself would be very, very different these days. And I don't know that it would be fully different because of, like, politics, or fully different just because I'm like a better writer and I would do things a lot different to what I would have done, you know, what is essentially like 15 years ago. So it would be an entirely different book. It's hard to really say how if this government would have influenced it a bit more. I kind of don't really like this Abbott government is a very right-wing conservative government and quite aggressive on it, it seems, in the first 6 months of its arrival here. But, you know, the treatment of asylum seekers and the treatment of race and things like that, that's a narrative that's sort of come out of the Labor years as well. And it's a narrative that began in the Howard years. It began in, like, the Tampa kind of children overboard sagas and stuff from that time, which really kind of vilified kind of like asylum seekers, and in particular vilified like people without a voice and that kind of deal. And the sad truth is that no government since then has really broken away from it because it allows them to get easy kind of political marks. And I think it creates a very poorer country because of it. Frankly, it's eternally shameful to watch what they do and what both sides of government have done in the last, like, decades for this kind of stuff.
No, I'd tend to agree with you there. And moving from one shameful aspect of culture to another, we've just weathered another Twitter firestorm, this time over the appointment of Jonathan Rost, he was to be the host of LondCon. And while we'll leave it to others to discuss some valid concerns that would have been raised to his appointment, I wanted to ask you how you have seen, because like myself, you've been around long enough, how you've seen the advent of social media change the landscape in relation to authors and fandom?
You know, I don't know if... Yeah, I think in general my opinion is that social media has allowed people to stop talking to each other and has made it easier for people to start talking at each other more. Like, there's less of a desire for people to actually have a conversation about something than there is to sort of, like, just state your point, make it in the most, like, in the strongest way that you can, which is often the most inflammatory and most strident, and then sort of just move on, and then the people who believe your particular side jump in, and then the people who believe the other side jump in, and then everybody who's kind of in the middle just kind of says, you're all fucking idiots, and just sort of wander off and then come back and look at the wreckage afterwards and just kind of go, oh, fuck, seriously, you know? And, yeah, that's my general opinion on it. I think in certain ways it's had a lot of advantages. It's, like, introduced it's taken out the kind of, like, the barriers of space, you know, around the world, and it's sort of made it easier for people to connect to things they like and to discover books and publishers that they like and things like that. And I think that's very good, but I worry that the conversations are really just stopping and they're just kind of yelling at each other and stuff like that. And it seems, I don't know, man, if it seems this way to you, but it seems to me like every couple of weeks there's a new kind of argument in this scene. And, you know, it's just basically one side saying one thing, and the other side saying the other thing. And usually like there's points to be made, but they're just yelling at each other, man. There's no actual dialogue going on.
No, I often think that, yes, it enables you to find other people across the world that are the same as you. It still means that you stick to similar people who think similarly.
And it's kind of like an electronic ghettoization, you know, like, you know, you're creating your own intellectual ghettos that you're just going to go hide out in electronically until you need to rise up against somebody. And, you know, like, I think the Ross thing has been very embarrassing, actually, for the scene at large. And I think the sad thing about it at the end of the day is that whether or not he could have bought a mainstream kind of like gloss to the LawnCon thing and help sell some books is debatable, you know, and whether or not he would have been the right guy to host it, and that's debatable and stuff as well. But, I mean, that's always debatable. Everyone's going to feel one way about a host or another. But the unfortunate fallout of what did happen is that there's no doubt that a mainstream eye has been cast on speculative fiction, and it's not a pretty look that we're currently all bearing.
No, and the discussions that perhaps should have happened now will be overshone by the fallout of what's occurred. I wanted to move on past those unpleasant times.
Hey, look, I've been in my fair share of internet fights, too, man. I know how it works, you know.
Yes, we're all culpable.
Yeah, I often think this is my reformed phase because I've made a very conscious decision not to get involved in these sort of things. And so when I feel the urge to get involved, I just get up and I leave the computer. And I tell my girlfriend about it, and then that's it for me. It's a very reformed time. You know, no more fights, no more selling badges about, you know, I hate Ben Peake and stuff like that. So,
very, very good. I think we're mellowing in our old age.
Somewhat. Also, I must admit, at the height of it, I had people telling me that I would never be published in Australia, and that kind of took the gloss off some of the excitement. So.
Well, With your trilogy sale and with an increasing number of other Australian writers sort of being featured overseas on things like the Locus list or other recommended reading lists, is Australian science fiction fantasy coming of age or punching above its weight, or do you think it is just a feature of that increased communication?
I think it'll be part of that increased communication element. I don't actually think that a lot of Australian spec fic is... I don't think you can really acknowledge it as being independently Australian in a certain way. You know, despite the talent and the quality of the authors who get out and break out, by and large, it's not really because there's quality to their writing that can identify uniquely Australian. Speculative fiction allows a sort of like universal kind of, I guess, culture to come through, and I just find that unless you know that someone's Australian beforehand, 9 times out of 10 you don't know that they're an Australian author, and their work is not duly influenced by any real sense of Australianism to it. It's rather that sort of just, I guess what you'd call it, that monoculture kind of Western culture thing that we're all kind of suckling at the teat of, you know?
Yeah, I was put in mind of that question because I was listening to Cood Street a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking to Sean Williams about his Books of the Change, which were quite deliberately sort of South Australian in their imagery, and yes, that seemed to be the same response. They didn't, I don't know if they sold outside of Australia, so that Australianness didn't sell. Obviously, he's gone and written lots of Star Wars books and other books set overseas, which have done.
Yeah, for every example of that, though, for every example of like a book that's quite Australian in some way that hasn't sold outside, there are lots of examples of books that have. You know, I mean, there's Alexis Wright's Carpentaria, which is kind of like a, I guess you would call it, sort of like a magic realist indigenous kind of novel that is virtually unknown in Australia, but has this great reputation outside. I mean, it won awards in Australia, but I mean, you still can't really, most people haven't heard of it. And there are other people that have very uniquely Australian kind of like voices that are much more kind of translated outside Australia. So for every example, there's that. But in particular for speculative fiction, I would probably argue that it's something that's being challenged kind of now, really, and I think it's important to challenge it because what's kind of emerged, I would say, in the last, like, let's just say 100 years, right, last century of spec fic, is kind of like this terra nullis culture element of speculative fiction in general, right? So I just took the term terra nullis because I used it earlier, where it sort of says, you know, there was no culture before. If you've never heard the term, it essentially was applied to indigenous culture in Australia, like historically speaking. So terra nullis was kind of this idea that when you taught Australian history, Australia only really began when Captain Cook and all the colonists and convicts arrived, you know, in the 1700s. And before that, there was basically no culture and no people to speak of before that. And it's just an awful kind of thing. But a similar kind of thing does exist in speculative fiction in that it's almost like all the white people... Oh, sorry about that. All the white people have sort of landed on the shore of this genre, and they've created it, you know, and they kind of just don't acknowledge any other kind of cultures around it or anything that came before or anything that's outside it. So you've got a really kind of like whiteness that runs through it, and the whiteness is kind of Western, but it's also very kind of blank and it kind of empty. I think that element has unfortunately become something very fused to speculative fiction, where people believe they can divorce the genre from any kind of cultural elements whatsoever.
So in that sense, you know, they'll perhaps tip their hat to antecedents like, well, say, Frankenstein and maybe Jonathan Swift and that sort of... They'll recognise those cultural feeders, but perhaps not those that we might have got from other cultures, say the Southeast Asia or
yeah, and
those other feeders. Yeah,
yeah, and I also think that it leads to like an illusion that, you know, like it goes back to that idea of the conservatism of fantasy, for example. You know, I mean, most of those government structures and all that kind of stuff are very kind of, you know, Western Dark Ages kind of, you know, that kind of time frame kind of stuff, you know, feudal times, all that kind of jazz. And to a degree, there's a certain element of people that say, oh, well, that's not really any kind of cultural stuff. That's just... Right. You know, a fake world. It's not really taking off from the real world, but kind of is, you know. It's just feeding out of that, and you're just ignoring it because you can't, because you're failing to acknowledge that it is.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm also put in mind of the recent book by Nicola Griffith, is it? Hild?
Oh, yeah. I haven't read that.
No, neither have I. I thought it was very interesting that some early criticisms of it by people on Goodreads and Amazon. So take that with that qualifier, but that they couldn't handle the first 50 pages or so because the terms were so alien. So you've got, you know, 7th century place names in England, and so I thought that's an interesting, almost a divorcing from Western culture in that sense, that, you know, that there is not that appreciation of those early streams. And I mean, you're talking about Dark Ages sort of, you know, around that time, so yeah.
Well, I mean, I just think it's just an interesting kind of concept. I view it as kind of like I do really think that science fiction has kind of created its own terra nullius, so to say, to a degree. It's created this whole thing where it doesn't acknowledge non-white kind of cultures. And I think a lot of the challenges that are coming up on it and have been coming for the last couple of decades are of people saying, we want the genre to acknowledge these things. We want the genre to deal with these things. We demand it as both a reader and a writer. And yeah, I think it is, generally speaking, it is the big challenge for the genre, I think, to acknowledge and to start incorporating and dealing with in a healthy way, in a good way, and not in an exploitive way, all the non-white kind of elements of our world.
Mm. No, and I was just thinking then, as you were finishing off, that There seems to be every 10 years, like somebody hits a reset button on the history of the genre, and you've sort of got to dig out, you know, influences from women, from black people, from gay and lesbian writers, you know, because the narrative is, oh well, you know, in the past it wasn't like this, but you know, these people, I hate to use that term, but you know, the diversity was always there knocking on the door. But I suppose we've got to hitting the reset button to some extent and just acknowledge.
Yeah, I have this theory, actually, that I've been flown around in my head for a while. And it began as a theory for the Australian spec fic scene, actually, that you get roughly between 5 to 6 years to kind of make your name in it. And then the scene kind of resets. And so if you don't make your name in it or get yourself established in those 5 to 6 years, you kind of fade away, disappear, or you face a struggle to establish yourself again. And I think that maybe can be applied to that 10 years. I mean, every 10 years is a roll around of a new generation of people. And if these things aren't established, then they do kind of get reset and the conversations begin a lot with them again, because a whole new generation comes in, edited in first from the previous generation. And so, yeah. But I don't have anything to back that up. That's just a theory that goes around my head.
Just a theory.
Yeah, I like my theories, man, but it doesn't have any real, like, evidence.
Evidence to back it up.
Yeah, there's no empirical kind of data or anything there. That's just me sort of, like, you know, sharing some sort of wisdom I pulled out of my various parts.
Okay. Well, I'll go into the last question. Both of us have had discussions, or type discussions at least, in the past about literary criticism, and I caught a conversation on Twitter, not between yourself and somebody else, but another Australian author talking about literary criticism. Now, personally, if I've got this right, you're all for it in any form. Once your work is out there, it doesn't really belong to the author anymore, and authors need to develop a thick skin. And I was wondering, are there any features of the Australian scene, be it broad literature or even like narrower genre scenes, that are really unhelpful for the growth of healthy criticism?
Didn't I say earlier I wasn't getting into these kind of arguments? You know, I say that I often talk to my girlfriend. Where is she? Well, I guess she's not here, so you'll have to suffice. No one will listen anyway. Look, you know, the criticism that the Australian scene in particular has had and still has a real problem of criticism, with good criticism, with healthy criticism, with anything that takes you to task one way or another. And the problem with the scene is that it's just too small. You know, I mean, what's the great description I once ever heard actually came from Jonathan Strahan, and he said that the Australian scene was one phone call wide and one phone call deep. You know, and that really does kind of sum it up, because if you think about it, you can reach anybody in the Australian scene with one degree of separation. All you got to do is find that one person that'll connect you to someone else, and you can reach them. Even someone like me, who's like pretty much reclusive and don't really hang around with people, even I can reach pretty much anybody with one phone call, you know what I mean? And that's just the nature of it, has just made it unhealthy, because so much of the reviews were basically, you know, your friends doing you a favor, and or your friends not being as harsh, because you know, you want to create a narrative for a book and for a text that everyone will get behind, and you want them to do well. You don't want to see your friends do bad. You don't want to see them get bad reviews and lose money and struggle to publish more books and stuff like that. I mean, there's a very real consequence that comes out of that for some people, you know, and you don't want to be responsible about it for your friend. But on the other hand, you know, once a book is out there, it's not you, you know, and everything has to stand to its quality of literature, and everything has to exist, and you know, we have to maintain that quality if we want books to continue growing and being good. You know, one of the things that sort of emerges kind of like, I guess now, especially as self-publication and all that kind of stuff really takes off, and authors are in much more control of their own work, is the idea of being your self-critic and being aware of things and growing kind of like the quality of the scene. Because in particular for speculative fiction, so much of the stuff is just shit. I mean, there's a whole lot of it that's badly written, and a lot of it is our classics, you know. I mean, a lot of it is kind of like the stuff that we honestly sit here and we say, this is the canon of speculative fiction. I mean, you know, Isaac Asimov and things like that, and the Frank Herbert Dune book and shit. They're all awfully written books. They're terrible. You know, basic pro skills and things like that are awful. So it's important for us as a genre if we want to grow and continue this mainstream edge that we're having, that where we're seeping into mainstreams and stuff like that. We have to maintain a quality element to it, and we have to be able to compete with things that are the top end of like the literary criticism and stuff like that. I mean, we have to compete against that, but there's no way that you can uphold, say, a Michael Ondaatje book and Terry Brooks novel. You know, you can't look at the pair of them and go, wow, the quality of writing here was really quite similar and unique. And that Michael Ondaatje, he better watch out, because Terry Brooks is coming up, you know. there's just not that there. And I feel very strongly about the fact that it's good for the scene to be taken to task for its shit, you know. My background is like academic writing and things like that, and I've seen works pulled apart, and there's a joy in pulling apart works and rejoicing in good things and seeing how things work. And there's a joy in writing criticism as well, that's not for the author, but is for people, you know, to read and to enjoy itself. I mean, I enjoy reading good criticism, you know. I enjoy reading the intellectual kind of like discussions and debates about books, and there's a real joy in that. And I think the Australian scene really kind of suffers from that, because that joy never really is given any chance to exist because of like the smallness of it. And I think that just feeds into a larger kind of spec fic problem. But I mean, the people taking reviews badly is everywhere. I mean, you know, you don't have to go too far to find someone who's taken a review in a poor light and gone off and been upset about it. So yeah, you know, I don't know. That sort of answer the question?
Oh, I think you danced a very good dance, and that was very well put, I thought. The conversation I was privy to on Twitter, and I won't mention names because I think that was part of what the person was pointing out, is that this wasn't in spec fic, but in the wider, but not too much wider, Australian literary scene, is that because of the size of the scene, that you couldn't have healthy criticism, because if you were an author who was being a critic and writing about other Australian authors, the potential to put noses out of joint, to cut off your, you know, for example, arts grants and that sort of thing, just through a clash of personalities, was, the person was feeling that they, you know, that good, healthy criticism couldn't develop or couldn't continue to grow because of those restrictions I guess basically the size of the community.
Well, I think the problem with it is, look, I think it can exist. I just think it's not going to come from the author's side. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, you know. And it's kind of like the problem with criticism is in one way is, if you look at it as kind of a band, you know, the author is kind of like the lead singer and guitarist of the band and gets all the kind of like cred and all that kind of stuff. And the reviewer or critic is kind of the roadie who puts up the mics and nobody ever pays attention to them. You know what I mean? So there's not a lot of glamour in being the critic outside of very few kind of like examples. But I think if we're going to develop a very kind of like honest kind of element of criticism and things like that, I think it's going to come from outside people in this scene. I think it's going to come from people who are genuinely legitimately kind of interested in it, which opens up a larger kind of conversation to be having about the way we teach criticism to people to begin with. And that stuff. But I should say, you know, it's not all bad. Like I actually quite like Goodreads, and I quite like Amazon comments and things like that. But I actually think Goodreads has been this really quite wonderful kind of thing that allows a very communal response to books to come out. Every book ever, you know, I mean, I there are people who aren't there to, like, basically bag out authors. I mean, you have to wonder about people who didn't like the first book in a series and then buy all seven that go along with it so they can bag it out. I mean, you know, dude, man, I don't have the time for that. But, you know, so that's how some people enjoy their spare time, so whatever. But overall, I think the Goodreads kind of community and stuff like that is actually quite good. You know, I think allowing people to give their views on books and to talk about it is actually very healthy, and having a venue for it and that kind of deal, you know, for all that that's worth, I guess. You know? But I will say in my less kind of like classy years, I guess you would say, I did actually attempt to just write criticism and just to do it without any concerns whatsoever, and to just, you know, be honest to the book and not to give, you know, a shit about the author. And, you know, it was fun times, but, I mean, it was basically like a really quick way to get people pissed off with you and to basically make them sort of like write really kind of nasty things about you. Some of that stuff which still goes around, you know what I mean? There are still people who say bad things about me regardless, and have negative opinions that come out of the fact that I did all that stuff. And, you know, I did it because I genuinely love criticism, and I think it's a very interesting, very cool thing to read. But you don't write it because you want to make a friend of the author. I mean, the author is just some entity that is either there to be kind of praised or there to be put down.
Well, I think you answered that very well, Ben. it's quite... Without that sounding sort of patronising, but no, it's I can't say there's not something that figures on my mind every now and again. If I have given out a couple of cutting reviews, which I thought were fair, but yes, there's even without the author saying anything, when you're mixing in such a small group, you can think, especially if you're quite a reasonable person, you think, oh. You know, they've got this bad review. How are they feeling? So, you know, depending on the type of person you are, there is even, a self-censorship that can then creep in.
Yeah,
so.
And look, it's just one of the problems with you know, knowing all the people. But it's not just this scene as well. I mean, the Australian film scene suffers the same kind of deal. You know, I remember my brief stint as a reviewer for films, very brief, I might add. In fact, I managed one. And, you know, I mean, I never really got beyond the one because I wrote one review and I didn't like the film, and the magazine told me that other people did and they knew the directors and people who made the film and could I make it nicer, and I said no. And, you know, I mean, that stuff goes around. I mean, I think David Stratton has kind of like pointed it out on a couple of occasions and stuff like that. And it's very complicated from inside the scene to do these things because people's livelihoods are on the line, you know?
Yeah, I suppose if you go to like a wider scene and you maybe look at reviews that would have been posted in the New Yorkers, or if they'd had a review columnist, that person was paid regardless of whether they wrote nice or nasty things. So there's I suppose that's an issue here, is that we don't actually have a culture that fosters paid critical review that's separate from...
No, well, that feeds into a larger debate about Australia, I think, which is that Australia really doesn't value its intellectualism, you know? Intellectualism in Australia is very much a sort of vocational kind of thing. It's unpaid. It's unacknowledged in a larger, broader sense. There's not the really revenues and money and things put into that, which is quite often why we see artists go overseas, why we see scientists go overseas and all that kind of stuff. And on a very kind of smaller level, you know, there's just not the kind of outlets where, you know, you can foster professional kind of criticism by giving people livable wages and saying, this is what you write, this is what you do, this is what you're paid to do. Go and develop your audience and create the work, you know?
Mm.
So
all my work as a blogger has been for naught.
I don't know, man. You're doing all right, though. You've got an audience for yourself.
Yep, you know? I can afford to pay myself in very good coffee once every 2 months. So.
Yep. look, man, I did at the very least, I would say 15 years of not even being able to, well, maybe buying coffee once every couple of months out of fiction. So it's a long road for everybody, you know. You know, I mean, even now, I mean, it's very nice to be able to, like, say that I've got a bit more money and stuff like that. But, like, you know, the road to get there was so kind of long and ridiculous, really.
Well, on that note, before I distract you from earning your keep, I'll say it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you, Ben.
That's so good.
Yeah, and thanks for the opportunity and good luck. When does The Godless come out?
The Godless will be out in August, around the LonCon thing, actually. So I will be at that, which will be, I'm sure, an amazing experience. Well, who knows, really? I'm not really a convention-driven sort, but I've decided that, you know, the book comes out around that time. I'm going to go to the UK, sort of say hi to people and do a few things for the book and then, you know, take the opportunity that's there. And, yeah, so it'll be around August, around the launch of that. Yeah, before that, though, everybody should go out and buy, obviously, the Dead Americans book, because it has the title that offends some people. And, you know, which, speaking of Goodreads, you know, before the book was even released, someone had given me 1 star on that based off the title. I was like, sweet. Excellent. You know? So, you know, and I can only imagine that certain people are buying the book because of the title too. So,
yeah.
It's winners everywhere.
All right, you've heard that, listeners. Go out and buy Dead Americans and heavily criticise it.
Yeah, because no, Ben don't can take do that. It. You know, I want people to buy the book, man. Say nice things. Then email your criticisms privately, you know, to Sean, not to me. I don't want to hear them. I like criticism. Just, you know, I don't really want to read my own failings. That's a bit narcissistic, you know.
Yeah.
So send other people them, you know.